welcome to another episode of Sacred Cinema here on 2XX 98.3 FM, People Powered Radio. I'm your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, for the next half hour, and this week's episode is entitled Kidnapped. Minutes and 15 seconds or so, consider yourself kidnapped by me, and I'm going to tell you all about films in which there's some a plot point where a character gets kidnapped or they get held hostage, essentially a situation in which a person, an important character in the film, is locked away somewhere and they can't get away because someone's got them there and they're not letting them go. And obviously, we're not talking on this film very often, I mean, constantly talking about sort of the symbolic value of these things that we talk about, these common images or common themes or common characters that we talk about on the show. I think of all the week we've ever done, there's such an obvious metaphorical quality to someone being kidnapped in that it's pretty much a straight up and down symbol for depicting a sense of, I guess, what you might call sort of false imprisonment in quick and dirty terms, but essentially lacking freedom without being the person who's responsible for that. So lacking freedom, without being the one that brought that upon yourself. So in kind of purely abstract or thematic terms, you could say this is arguably the most undesirable situation a person can think of, where they can't do something and it's not their fault that they can't do it, in very crude and simple terms. But we're going to sort of dig deep into the more nuanced elements of that and how things have sort of changed, as we do every week, sort of how things have sort of changed through the history of cinema and depictions of kidnapping, who's doing it, how they're doing it, how things have kind of stayed the same in some ways and have become very different as the culture shifted. So the films we're going to be talking about, the first one is going to be John Ford's film from 1956, The Searchers. We're then going to move on to Mikhail Haneke's Mikhail Haneke's. So that would be Michael Haneke's Funny Games. We're gonna talk about both the 1997 one and the 2007 one because they are ostensibly the same, except one's with Austrians and the other one's with Americans. But I think it's worth sort of touching on both of them. And then we're going to finish off with Ben Affleck's 2007 film Gone Baby Gone. But let's kick things off now with Mr. John Ford's 1956 film The Searchers. So if you haven't seen this one, basically you've got John Wayne and a posse of cowboys, which quickly becomes a duo of cowboys looking for a girl that was kidnapped by a Comanche tribe when she was little. And for 2 hours, we pretty much just follow them looking for her. And there's a couple of other characters that come along in the way, but in the sort of the vast landscapes of, well, I've been to Monument Valley, so I know it's in Arizona, but in the film, they're going across the Western frontier looking for this girl, and she could be all over the place sort of thing. And I want to talk about how this film depicts a very unique form of exhaustion, I suppose you would say, being in no uncertain terms, I guess, the tragic exhaustion or the kind of exhaustion that's very tragic that comes from recovering what you might call a stolen soul. So if we think, or anything that's been stolen or anything that you can't get your hands on that you deeply value, you could say, or you have a sentimental or a deep connection with. But it's a very kind of tragic exhaustion in looking for something that's dear to you for a very long time. And let's break down that word exhaustion to begin with and how exhaustion is conveyed in this film. I think it's quite obvious, for these big, vast, open landscapes. And last week we talked about Lawrence of Arabia and some very similar imagery with its epicness and its openness. It's also very hot and dry. Obviously, you've got the red sand and, they're constantly drinking and rationing water. And even though that's not really talked about, they talk about rations a little bit, but even if it's not that much talked about, you can't help but think about it when you watch the film. Like, how do cowboys not get headaches all the time riding around all day in the hot sun and having like one bottle of water for like 3 days? It sort of just senses the view. But then obviously we've got the title of the film, which is The Searchers. And it is, as I mentioned before, ostensibly a two-hour long film of a couple of guys riding around the countryside looking for a kidnapped girl. And so they're in a state of searching the entire time. It's very obvious. But there's an element of tragedy to this film. And the John Wayne character, Ethan, I'm going to give it a little bit away if you haven't seen the film here, so just be mindful of that. he is sort of confronted by the end of this film, or near the end of this film, by a unique sense of worthlessness and futility. You might call it kind of like a very pessimistic sort of cynicism, a kind of giving upness. He kind of gives up, I guess you could say. And this intersects with this theme of the film, which is why the film's a little bit controversial, and I think it's worth touching on, is this idea of being of co-opting culture, so a different culture sort of co-opting one of your own. And, you know, big, strong, tall, white American cowboy man John Wayne doesn't like the idea of one of his own being sort of co-opted by the Comanche culture. With that, before getting into sort of the questions of racism and stuff like that in this film, I think that this is a very 1950s idea, racism aside, in that it's very much a time, and there's a very clear connection here, not that it was intended, when they made Rebel Without a Cause a few years later, but this idea of youth being unrecoverable as a result of their co-opting, the baby boomers becoming a rebellious culture or subculture and not being able to get them back. And I guess you could say the real sneaks from that generation might say, if John Wayne was right here right now, still with us, he might say that they never came back. And so I think this was a very 1950s idea of the youth being, you know, co-opted and almost like not choosing to be, this sort of foreign culture coming in and taking people away and not being able to get them back. And this leads him to a sort of sense of worthlessness. So, you know, grandpa's upset that the grandkids don't like listen to the music of his day or don't like the way they've turned out, and he kind of gives up on the youth sort of thing. Now, we have to talk about sort of the racial elements of the film, and I'm not going to skirt over the fact that, I mean, John Wayne was known to be quite cynical of Native American rights and things like that publicly. But, I mean, we can't ignore the fact that the depictions of the Comanches in this film are somewhat caricaturistic. But I don't want to go as far as to say that the themes of the film are racist. And I'm not the first person to say this either, so I don't think it's a particularly hot take. I think if you really watch the film honestly, I think the themes of the film are quite actually anti-racist, or at least that's how I interpreted them. Because because when we talk about John Wayne sort of being the racist of the film, let's say, both inside and outside of the universe of the film, it's interesting that the qualities of the person who sort of sees hope in this whole situation and does feel like the Natalie Wood character, if I didn't mention before, Natalie Wood is both in this and Rebel Without a Cause, I don't think I mentioned that before, but his hope in being able to recover her from this foreign group, if we can just say that to keep things above board for a second, that's embodied by the younger of the duo. And so the more sort of the old hand that's been around and knows how to swing a lasso, he's actually proven to be wrong in this sense in the film. His defeatedness, his sense of being defeated is shown to be kind of irrational by the end of the film. So it's interesting that these qualities are embodied, the more positive or hopeful qualities are embodied the qualities of being sort of giving up are embodied more by the learned member of the duo, or the one who's more learned at the beginning. And the green and kind of fresh sidekick is the one that maintains hope. So it is kind of this archetypal dynamic of the old pessimist versus sort of the hopeful sprouter, you could sort of say. And I think this is indicative of a much broader symbol that the film definitely gets into, which is the search for anything, I suppose, right, is an exhausting and tragically exhausting endeavor. And it's something that is we more often attribute to or align with older generations, because they've been around and they have a reason to be pessimistic. Whereas young, hip, progressive people who might not know as much about the world and haven't been defeated by it yet sort of still think that there might be hope, so to speak. Now, that might be changing as time goes on, but in 1956, this is kind of this idea that despite the fact that this long and hot and arduous journey has taken so much out of the John Wayne character, the younger of the duo, the younger chap of the duo, who I should have mentioned was played by Jeffrey Hunter, it's the Martin character, he's the one that has more hope. And it almost leaves us with a sense of, don't fear the idea of someone being kidnapped by a foreign culture. Don't fear the idea of someone who you did love going away and coming back a different person. That's not necessarily a bad thing. And in 1956, they have to do it in this very, very subtle and implicit way. But I think that's really what the film is kind of saying. So it's not, I don't think it is sort of I don't think that's a racist interpretation. In fact, it's quite the opposite, which is to say that in a globalized society, or an increasingly globalized society, there are things that people can come back from learning new things, almost like in a traditional hero story sense, and come back and still be the people we once knew and the people we once loved. And that's not, it doesn't completely tarnish who they are by any means. I don't think it goes as far. I don't think the film goes as far as that she's more sort of enlightened than she could have been. And I think that's a theme that'll come out more in cinema in the years following 1956. But at least this is sort of the first step in that journey that we later see in those kinds of films. But moving on now, because is it always the case that we have this dynamic where society can kind of be divided into like two sides, like the local and the foreign, with one trying to kidnap the other all the time? Is that really how society is actually structured? Well, let's move on to our next film now. Before we do, just remind you about listening to 2XX98.3 FM, People Powered Radio. I'm your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, for the remainder of this half-hour slot. And be sure to jump onto our station if you would like to subscribe or sponsor the show. And also, you can get in contact with me. You can email me at contact@jimmybernasconi.com. But moving on now to Michael Haneke's 2007 films, Funny Games. And if you haven't seen these ones, basically we've got upper class family that go on their summer vacation, their summer house, and they're held hostage in their own home by these two boys who we never actually find out what their story is. And I want to talk about the subtlety of how this film or these films depict the subtlety of a kidnapping or being held hostage. It doesn't really matter for this point. So the film is called Funny Games, and part of why it's called that is because in taunting this family, the boys keep talking about, let's play another game, let's play another game. And they have these kind of sick and twisted games that they sort of play while threatening to kind of kill this family. And it's quite well known that Haneke is influenced by Wittgenstein, who of course talked about language games. And we're going to get too much into it because I think it's kind of been talked about by other people, but just in brief terms, Wittgenstein kind of talks about how language is sort of something that's, it's a bit, well, not in his first, not in his first book, but his second one, he talks about how language is determined, is sort of negotiated, like how people negotiate rules and strategy in a game, but sort of between multiple participants, and things sort of change and sort of in their given context, those rules and sort of things sort of change in their given context. And I think in this film we talk about, you use the word game, this film very much puts an emphasis on there being a winner in those games. So when you come up with the rules and the norms and the customs of a given negotiation or a game between another person in social life, I think this film sort of lifts up how there can be, clearly lifts up how there can be a winner in negotiating those terms, in negotiating those rules and performing certain strategies. So we have to focus on the manner of the boys, the two boys that do the hostage taking. They're very civil. They're very soft and polite. They're very clean. They're almost quite calming at first. Like the Brady Corbett character his performance in the American version, even though people talk about the American version poorly, I actually really think his performance is fantastic in the American one. How he uses his voice and how he changes his face to be like kind of innocent and very non-threatening at all. And so I do want to go down this road very briefly, which is that specifically with respect to the American one, with the film coming in, film year like 2007, is that by them having this kind of waspy Hamptonsy kind of look to them, because I keep talking about golf and wearing golf gloves the whole time, you could say in a very specifically traditional sense that they have a comforting presence in that, to use very stereotypical or very conventional ideas around parts of America that are generally safe and generally civil, you would think about a place like the Hamptons or somewhere like that. Now, these days, we have a very different concept of that because we have the whole psycho white people subgenre of horror films, which kind of kicked off with something like Get Out, and now we do feel kind of disconcerted when we see people like that in films. But if you imagine 1997 or 2007, which really wasn't that long ago, but it was a different culture at that time, it wasn't typically people from those places, because you understand my point, which is that it's a subversion of the traditional idea of those places being safe and secure, and the irony being no, they're actually just as dangerous as anyone, kind of thing. But typically, if we're going to use very typical or traditional imagery or traditional terms, they come across as archetypally reliable or I guess safe people to be around, but that's not really the case. And speaking of sort of being in the extremes, we're going to touch on that in a second, but keeping that in mind for the time being. And in the way that they conduct themselves, in that very civil way of being so polite, the victims of what they do really have no opportunity to do anything, despite having a 3-2 home ground advantage over these guys. And I do, if you haven't seen the film, I would recommend watching it twice and perhaps watching the Austrian version and the American version. And try and put that real kind of cinephile, mouth-breathing, plot-hole-searching, plot-hole-hungry hat on. And, you know, those guys that love explaining why Star Wars is actually, this wouldn't have happened because of the Death Star, like that kind of thing. There really aren't that many plot holes in the film. I mean, I think it is quite an airtight plot cradled by very well-crafted and timed dialogue. It all feels fairly realistic, at least for the first part of the film. So this is despite the crazy and chaotic situation that the characters find themselves in. So great job, Hanukkah. I guess the point I'm trying to make is that the film very much depicts or lifts up an idea of how easy it can be to be kidnapped, right? To be coaxed, to be very subtly coaxed into a state of being kidnapped without really having a point at which you could have done anything about it, to lose those interactions, to lose those games, and to be subtly kind of almost like bullied into a place of being put into a corner and feeling you're playing by the rules the whole time. Then all of a sudden you find yourself tied up and with nowhere to go. And as I mentioned before, in this world of sort of archetypes or archetypally safe and civil people, we're in this world of extremes. And I think you could say that from the victim's perspective, even the most powerful, even the most privileged, economically privileged bourgeois people with secure gates around their house, protected by a lake and no way getting in, even they can be kidnapped. Even they can be, it's a bit like the film If, the schoolboy film If that we talked about many, many years ago, about even if, you know, privileged schoolboys can be treated this way, anyone can be treated this way. And I guess that begs the question, sort of how far can that go? If everyone's susceptible to some form of kidnapping, this kind of subtle and covert means of kidnapping, who else can be kidnapped? And to answer that question, I think the answer is the audience itself, or the audience members ourselves. Because the film is not a nice film, right? In a lot of ways, it can be sort of put away as torture porn. And I think the only way to not really give this film credit is to actually turn it off. I think I think you could say that if you get to the end of this film, you automatically liked it, or the film was automatically good. Not, I mean, you didn't automatically like it, but the film was automatically good in a sense, or achieved what it aimed to achieve. It's a bit like that joke, the Aristocrats, if you know that joke. You look up like the Gilbert Gottfried joke, the Aristocrats, on YouTube, if you don't know what I'm talking about, or Bob Saget or Sarah Silverman. They all do a different version of it. Despite the fact that this is utterly disgusting, a film, we stick around, and some of us even watch it twice, right? Even knowing the torture we're about to see and what we're about to be put through. And there's the obvious bits in the film where the bad guys break the fourth wall, which conflates them as kidnappers or hostage takers with being the controllers of the film, and there's an obvious point in the film where this really does happen, but they're in charge not only of the victims in this scenario, but of you and what you see. And when you get a sense of relief, they can change that and turn it how they like to. So as to say that as audience members, we are kind of kidnapped by the director when we walk into the theater and we stick around and see what they've got to show us. So I think we could take from this a broader suggestion that culture makers in general, not just filmmakers, but anyone that kind of makes culture and puts things in front of us that hold our attention, they hold us all as hostages of their own specific cultural ideas or ideologies or belief systems. And culture makers are kind of anything, you know, filmmakers, musicians, ballet dancers, whatever, the list goes on. So in one sense, when we're talking about the searches, we're talking about this idea that kidnapping is sort of something done by one group to another. And while it can be sort of exhausting or saddening to feel that, you know, the people we love are being taken over by other people, we have to fight against that sense of pessimism and have some more hope that we could maybe bring them back one day and bring them back to the people and perhaps even though they're even better people for it type thing. But then when we watch a movie like Funny Games, it's like, we're all, you know, no matter what, how you want to divide society into two groups, three groups, four groups, we're all subject to some kind of monolithic act of kidnapping. As long as you absorb the world around you, as long as you absorb culture, the ideology that is hegemonic in your given arena, in your given context, we're all to some degree controlled very subtly. We're very subtly coaxed into what can be a very horrible situation or state of affairs without even knowing about it. Or maybe we even do know what's happening in one sense, in one part of our psyche, but we don't really accept it. And that's, you know, that's sort of like the people that watch this movie more than once, even knowing that it's going to be a horrible situation, you still, without, you know, it exploits your curiosity. And I think that's very relevant also to the sort of the TikTok generation as well, knowing that it is hurting you, knowing that it's absorbing you, but you can't bear it, you can't help it. Look, anyway, I don't want to go down that rabbit hole, but I think this does lead to a question of where do we go from here? Well, let's try and finish off this week with Ben Affleck's 2007 film, Gone Baby Gone. And I hadn't seen this film, I hadn't seen any of these films until very recently. I really want to do Prisoners, the Denis Villeneuve film this week, and I think it would be very suitable, but I want to do, I've seen it a lot of times, and I want to do something that I've never seen before. I've been meaning to watch Gone Baby Gone before for a long time, never got around to it. And if you haven't seen it, it's about a little girl in Boston who's kidnapped, and Casey Affleck plays this private detective that has a very difficult job in more senses than one of bringing her back home. And I want to talk about how this film contemplates the benevolence of kidnapping, almost as to say that if it's so inevitable as sort of proposed in Funny Games, maybe it needs to be weaponized for good. So I think one of the really, I mean, this film to me is a 10 out of 10 film, by the way. Like, I was so choked up by this film, I gotta say. But I think so much of the strength of it is how sort of perceptive and deliberate it is in its depiction of, I don't like using this term, but everyday people. Sort of people that aren't particularly spectacular to look at, but sort of everyday people you might know from your childhood or from the everyday world to which you belong. And specifically kind of the innocence of the everyday person. There's a lot of imagery of children in this film, which is, I think, always very symbolic of how people find themselves, you know, wake up in a very complicated world, and a lot of us abide by and trust in people who really aren't capable of looking after us, whether that's a child to a parent or a citizen to a politician. Having trust in someone that isn't capable of looking after you is a crazy thing to do, and I think it chokes people up to think about that people, but the people really have trust in them. I think almost like the end scene in a film like About Schmidt, where we confide in people that aren't capable of looking after us or making the world better for us, but we abide by them anyway. And there's, you know, a lot of connections here with a film like Night of the Hunter as well, a Charles Laughton film, I think would be very suitable to compare with this film. And so it does beg this question, well, how are we supposed to protect such vulnerable people who need to rely on other people but have no one to rely upon? And last week we talked about the film Black Hawk Down, how it's so much, how it depicts a very sort of Bush-era idea. Yeah, in Black Hawk Down, sort of ignores the sovereignty of Mogadishu, of Somalia, and they just sort of went in there, sort of very paternalistically as human beings for the sake of humanitarianism. You know, like you can be paternalistic and it's okay in 2007. And interestingly, this film is from 2007. Black Hawk Down is from 2007. But there's almost this sense that people need to be protected through practical means, right? Which can sometimes mean lies, but you go in and you, even if there are rules around sovereignty or there are rules around personal space or parental ownership laws, and there's a great Ed Harris scene where he talks about, as a police officer, you know, he's planted evidence on people because he knows they're bad people and needs to protect their children. And this becomes the dilemma of the film, is the extent to which you go by the book when you know the book itself isn't actually going to look after these people, right? Even though Somalia has a sense of sovereignty, you kind of need to go in there to protect the people that it doesn't protect for itself, in the same way that even though a little kid in this bedroom, you know, is technically supposed to be looked after by their parent, you got to go in there and help her because you know that the law's not going to do the job. And so it does sort of lift up the idea of the benevolence of going against the book. And probably from just talking about it out loud like that, it's not really like a radical Bush era right wing idea. It's actually a very ancient idea. It's got a very Antigonian idea, referring to the play of Antigone, where we have this question of justice versus law, where something can be enacted in law, but we know it can't be trusted, or at least that there's more of a sense of a divine justice that transcends human law, and that we know there's you know the difference between you know going by the you know abiding by the law when you know that sort of deeper ethical or moral ideas are more important, particularly if you're a religious person. You can see that this has been the heart of a lot of human conflicts over the years, is you know whether you abide by God or whether you abide by your president or the policeman or something like that. And so bringing this back to kidnapping, the film kind of contemplates when and whether we should, well, I suppose, literally imprison people who haven't done anything wrong but deserve it and are threats to other people. So kidnap them in that sense, you know, to go back to that idea of false imprisonment. But it also lifts up an idea of removing people from places of danger, kidnapping people from a place of danger without their consent, without having the legal justification for doing so. If doing so you think and you're quite sure is going to be better for them. So it leaves us in a tricky place, isn't it? Because we started this conversation with, you know, the road to sort of returning displaced people is kind of tough, and it can get the better of the best of us. And that doesn't mean to say that we shouldn't try our best to return those who have been kidnapped and have a view that, you know, the world isn't divided into good and bad, and the baddies still the good people, and if they get stolen, they're suddenly baddies too. We have to have more hope than that. But even if we are strong enough to get those people back, and we are strong enough to see some positivity, to see a hopeful horizon beyond that, The co-opting or the kidnapping of our attention, of our beliefs and our ideas, is something that can be done so seamlessly and done by so many people that we can't ignore that it's always happening. You know, kidnapping almost seems like an inevitability, that it's happening on lots of different levels and it's unavoidable, and we're losing out in that game. It's happening to us all the time. So it's almost like, if it is so inevitable, if this broad-scale co-optation is inevitable, perhaps, you know, we need to be doing it. We need to, that idea of, you know, kidnapping as an action needs to be co-opted or weaponized, co-opted itself, but weaponized by the best of us. That if we know it's going to happen, maybe we should be the ones that do it if we're good people, and do it to make the world a better place. But this leaves us with a few challenges ahead, and it'll be interesting to see where films go from here in this era. Because in one sense, you know, how can we ever know whether we should have that power to kidnap, number one. And we can see that's the sort of, in today's world, there's a large sort of scale cynicism of traditional institutions for that reason. I mean, how can the person in charge, the prime minister or the president, how can we trust that they actually, you know, in telling us lies, that they should be the ones that have such a strong sense or a close sense of justice, that they should be the ones doing that. But by the same token, or at least the other side of that coin, what happens to those people who the institutions do protect and that do foster, right? There are innocent people that are protected by the state and institutions. And even if it's not done by the book, you know, it's not exactly clear where the line between corruption and revolution is. If we talk about going against the book and being anti-establishment, it's not really clear when one is happening and the other isn't happening. Going against the book is sort of synonymous with both of those ideas. So I guess we need to ask ourselves this question moving forward, is how can we ever be sure that our yearning to free the imprisoned is not in and of itself an effect of the shackles that have been placed on us by our own kidnappers? Well, that's all we've got time for this week here on Sacred Cinema. Thanks so much for tuning in. Stay tuned for more quality radio programming here on 2XX, and we'll see you again next week. Cheers.